This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Okay, well, this is a very special day, of course. It's Veterans Day, and I want to play a song to honor the veterans who are listening to the program and to remind all of you to support the veterans. I have been involved for many, many years in working with veterans and encouraging them to write. I have also been working on a project for the F-105 pilots and the ground crew. Now, this has taken me to a lot of places and meeting a lot of very wonderful people. And I was going to play the Air Force song, but I'm going to play instead today to honor two of my guests who have been on the program, Marines. I love Marines because twice in my life, when I was overseas, Marines saved my life. And once I was really in big danger, caught up right in the middle of a big, terrible, and very bloody demonstration. And I ran like crazy and listened. Luckily, I had always listened to my father. And he said, whenever you travel, wherever you go, the first thing you do when you get to a city is locate the American embassy. So I did that. I always listened to my father, and boy, oh boy, was he a great, was he smart. And I knew exactly where to run because I took off when I got in the middle of that demonstration, and I ran like crazy for blocks, but I knew exactly where I was going. And luckily, I had a map because I think they, I think if today they would have turned off all of the cell phones and I wouldn't have had GPS. But I had a map and I ran. And when I got to the embassy, and there standing right there, a Marine. And there is nothing more beautiful than a Marine. So I just want to play this song for them, and then I'm going to come back, and I want to talk about Thomas Ryan Jr. and his book, and also Johnny Clark. But let's play this song. I love it. Boy, this song is so beautiful, and I could actually play all of the songs today that celebrate our veterans. And you know, for me, when I've had the opportunity, I always make room for a vet if they contact me, because I believe so much in sharing the stories, not necessarily of the wars, although those are always fascinating, but also just helping vets to find something special in their lives to write about. It doesn't have to be about their war experiences, but just to be able to write. And with the problems that we have and that veterans have today, so many of them are suffering so much because of recent occurrences. And I just want everybody to reach out, and there are so many different veteran organizations that you can take part in, including the USO, but many others, and you find one that suits your needs and your the things that you're interested in, and support veterans. And one of the things I want to do is to talk today about these two authors. Johnny Clark first came on the show a long time ago, and I was so impressed with him. Here he comes in, and I thought, oh wow, this is amazing, because he's an award-winning author, and he wrote a book that my father wanted to be a Marine, actually. And when he was listening to the radio on the day that Pearl Harbor happened, he got up, and it was Sunday, and he immediately went downstairs. He said he was in the attic, and he had the bedroom in the attic, and he was a big tall guy, and he sat up and he bumped his head. But he ran downstairs, and the first thing he said, of course, to the family was, well, I'm going to go and join up. And his mother said, well, they're not open today. I don't think they'll be open today. On that Monday morning, he ran, and unfortunately, he was in northern Michigan, where, of course, I was born, and he slipped and fell and broke his leg. And so it was a little bit devastating to him, and because he, of course, was out of action for a while. But when he got back on his feet, what he did is he joined the Army. He didn't join the Marines as he had actually originally planned. But with that in mind, that was why he always loved the Marines and always wanted me to make sure that I honored them. And so that's why I am doing this today. So let's talk about Thomas Ryan Jr. He wrote a book which, you know, he had a lot of experiences as a Marine. And he wrote a book called Terrorist Quest for Power. Now, this is an example of what you can do. You know, you retire. He was a successful businessman. For years, he was, you know, involved always in business, making companies and growing companies. And then when he retired, he looked back at what he had done as a Marine, and he said, you know, I think there's a story in this. And this shows you exactly what I've always been telling everyone. It's never too late to start writing. It's amazing what you can accomplish when you decide to start writing and find that joy on paper. And Thomas Ryan Sr. found that joy. And in this book, Terrorist Quest for Power, he puts together a real thriller based on his experiences and some of the international intrigue that he was involved in. And it's a suspense, it's a drama, and the characters just are fascinating. One of them is the main character is Major Tom Murphy. He's on assignment, and it's an exciting story, and I hope that you will get this book, because I just love to support Marines, and I love to support good writing and authors who start a little bit late in life. You don't have to give up just because, you know, you have a business and you're busy for years. When the time comes, when you're ready to find that joy on paper, it'll come to you, and it is wonderful. And so I'm so happy that Tom was on the program, and I hope he's working on his second book in this, what I think is going to be a trilogy. So this is the name of the book again is Terrorist Quest for Power, and it was released just this year in April 2021. And then, oh wow, the next one, Johnny Clark. Johnny Clark is so special. He is an award-winning author. His book Guns Up, which is the first-hand account of the Vietnam War, is fantastic. I love this book, and it should have been made, and I think it was optioned, and it should have been made into a movie, because it is so exciting, and it has been used in military courses to train military people, because it is really so, it's filled with all sorts of wonderful you know, ideas, as well as the story of what happened to him in Vietnam. And one of his other books that I really love is called Gunner's Glory. And this is about the Guadalcanal. And this story is incredible. Anybody who has read anything about World War II knows what happened at Guadalcanal. And Johnny Clark brings it to life. And I love this book. So you have wonderful choices here to support veterans today. Check out their books, Johnny Clark and Thomas Ryan Sr. Get their books and support them, and support all veterans that you know. And make sure that today, I've already started this morning, I started off at 3 o'clock in the morning sending messages to the veterans who I have known over the past 10 years since I have been working on a project called F-105, The Forgotten Warriors. So I have been doing that all morning. So if you have any vets in your life, anyone you know who served and protected us, this is the day to make sure that you reach out and talk to them. And while I'm talking about Johnny Clark, I want to play, you know, his books on you know, serious battles like the Guadalcanal are fascinating. But he also has a great sense of humor. And we're going to play his promo for one of his other books. Well, that's a little funnier, but it is also a wonderful book. I love books that make me laugh out loud. And this is a military book. And when you think about it, when you hear what he says in the promo, that, well, you listen to it, and then I'll talk about it.
From the author of gut-wrenching novels Guns Up and Gunner's Glory, now a gut-wrenching comedy, Section 8. One fan writes, Section 8 is inspired insanity. Johnny Clark should receive the Pulitzer Prize and his commitment papers in the same ceremony. You will laugh till it hurts. Section 8. It's 1946, and President Harry Truman has two goals in life: dump the U.S. Marine Corps and get reelected. Can he convince Congress that the Marine Corps is obsolete? He'll try, but first he wants to use them one last time. There's something he needs them to do, a little mission to China to steal something that one of his contributors need. It's dangerous, but who cares? Marines are expendable, or so he thinks. What could possibly go wrong? A lawsuit by the Vatican? An attempted assassination by a dead assassin? Flamethrower sermons? If that's not enough, there's a missing A-bomb. This book has it all, even a love story. Remember, Section 8 is only a temporary state. You hope, written by a true American hero. You'll love this book, now available on Amazon. So get it today. Section 8 by Johnny Clark. Semper Fi.
Oh, this book is so funny. You will really. At one point in this book, I was laughing so hard, my jaw ached. It's hilarious. And to think, I mean, I had never known that President Truman wanted to get rid of the Marines. But it's true. And you think about it, and you think about all that the Marines have done for us. Well, it is really, it makes you a little bit crazy. But it is a wonderful book. And so there's humor in everything, and certainly Johnny Clark finds it in that book. Now, I want to go to commercial earlier than normal, because I'm waiting for a call-in from a National Geographic author and photographer. And as everyone knows, I make November Nat Geo gift-giving day for Thanksgiving, because I always give Nat Geo books on Thanksgiving and have one out so that when people come over to your house, that they can turn it into a yearbook style event. You open the book while you're busy doing whatever, you have your guests sign the book and write little notes and little things, just like they did in high school. But this way it becomes a memento for you and a something that you will treasure forever. And there are so many books, and I am recommending them on my Facebook page, which is Radio Joy on Paper, and on my website, Radio-Joy on Paper. Go there. I have a Nat Geo gift-giving day suggestions, a list of the books that I think you should use as a yearbook-style welcoming for your guests. But let's go first to commercials, and then by then I hope that my next caller will be ready to talk to me.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to Toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z, and I am back, and I am so thrilled to welcome to Joy on Paper Thomas Peschek, and the name of his book is Wild Seas. Hi, Thomas.
Hi, Patsy. How are you? Good morning.
Good morning. Oh, wow. As everyone knows in my audience, I use Thanksgiving Day as a National Geographic gift-giving day. And I always give National Geographic books away, and I have them always ready for my guests to sign them while we're waiting to eat the turkey. And this book, wow, my guests will just be turning the pages and sitting there in awe of your magnificent photos. You are incredible.
Thank you so much for your kind words.
Well, you know, Nat Geo photographers are all great. You guys and gals are so amazing. And you put together these wonderful and beautiful books for everyone. And this book, particularly, you know, I love the sea. I live here in Clearwater, Florida, so I'm always looking at the water. And in your case, you know, you have just captured with your beautiful photography, things that it takes us into, you know, it's almost surreal. You can't believe that anything is so gorgeous and what you find.
Well, look, you know, during my, you know, 15 years as a National Geographic photographer, I have made more than a million photographs. And for this book, I've really spent months, I mean, scouring my archives and, you know, and trying so hard to select my favorite 200 images that I've made on you know, dozens of challenging expeditions to some of the planet's wildest seas and most coastline. And the photographs in this book, they really tell, you know, stories of unique animals, be they great sharks,
Just a minute, Thomas. We're getting an echo. Is your phone on speaker, or I don't know, for some reason?
No, I'm talking through my Skype normally through the computer. Everything else is off.
Okay. All right. So continue. I'm sorry to interrupt. I just wanted to make sure because it was a little bit of interference there. So as you were saying, you had a million photographs. This is incredible.
Yep, and I had to cull that down to 200 images made on many, many challenging expeditions. And the photographs in this book, they really tell the stories of unique animals, you know, whether it's great white sharks or manta rays or marine iguanas or common dolphins. And they really showcase, you know, pristine and wondrous places like the Galapagos or the Seychelles or Antarctic Islands. And I think together, collectively, they really tell the story of our planet's rich, yet also fragile ocean ecosystem. And I think, but the book tells also my own personal story, you know, from this fish-obsessed 10-year-old boy to becoming a marine biologist, you know, working on kelp forest ecology, and then later making the leap to National Geographic photographer and explorer.
Well, as I've always said to all of the Nat Geo people, you guys have the most wonderful job. it's so incredible that you get paid to do something that you love so much. And now you started, explain why at 10 years old you started this whole sort of quest for the sea.
Being on a beach, it's noisy. There's lots of people, there's lots of distractions. And then, you know, within a few seconds, when you put your head underwater, and all of a sudden everything's quiet. And you're literally on this different, you know, in this different alien realm within 3 seconds off the beach. And just my early snorkels at that age, they just really influenced how I looked at the ocean since then. And from that age onwards, I wanted to be a marine biologist. No plan B, no other option. I told every single person I met I was going to be a marine biologist. And, I ended up working on kelp forest ecology and doing that for a number of years and then made the leap to fuller journalism, you know, later on. And the book really reveals what life is like on assignment for National Geographic. You know, the highs and the lows, the agony and the ecstasy, warts and all. I mean, what does it take to, you know, repeatedly travel to the edges of the world and come back with these iconic photographs you see, be it in the book or the magazine or on National Geographic Instagram feed, and the book was really inspired by two emotions. It was inspired by love and by fear. Love for the oceans and fear that future generations simply will not get to experience them the way I have.
You know, it's so appalling when you see photos of the plastic, just the plastic alone floating in the sea. When you see this, it breaks your heart. And I am so honored, really, that you're here today, because perhaps this book and everything that Nat Geo is doing to help conservation, to make people aware of the importance of nature, and particularly of the seas, it's so beautiful. It as I said, when you can get just lost in these photos of yours. I found myself, you know, just staring at them and saying, wow, it's just magnificent. And that we are just trashing the oceans is disgusting.
You know, I really consider myself a matchmaker of sorts. And the truth is, you can't fall in love with something you don't know exists. It's really that simple, but also, you know, that profound all at the same time. And it is my job as a National Geographic photographer to dive beneath that, you know, reflective, mirrored ocean surface and to reveal this alien realm to people. Because, you know, first of all, I think we need to inspire people. And to do that, I show them these beautiful, pristine marine habitats, and I introduce them to these magical creatures that hopefully they fall in love with and they go, wow, I cannot believe a place as beautiful as this really exists on our planet. But of course, as a photojournalist, I also have to show that darker side of our relationship with the ocean, you know, pollution, the impact of climate change, and overfishing. And I always walk this fine line between inspiring and disturbing. I think too much beauty might result in complacency, while too much gore and death leads to hopelessness. So I always try hard, whether it's in my books or magazine articles, whatever, to tell these balanced stories and get people to think, to act, and fall in love, and ultimately, you know, make a difference themselves by changing their behavior and by living in a way that contributes to ocean conservation rather than behave in ways that actually contributes to the, you know, degradation of our oceans.
Well, you have had so many adventures in this career of yours. Tell us about what are some of the more dangerous events that have occurred in, because some of the places you go and some of the photographs you've captured have put you in danger.
I'd say the dangerous thing I do is cross the road during rush hour traffic in Miami and New York City. That's pretty scary as far as I'm concerned. No, but the pictures that I'm trying to make, I think as a National Geographic photographer, I strive to show you all something that you've never seen before. So that, you know, requires me to document incredibly remote and nearly impossible to get to locations like, you know, Arctic volcanoes inhabited by penguins and albatrosses, or remote atolls, you know, just filled with, you know, healthy shark populations, or, you know, and things like that. And getting to these places is difficult. You know, it's a lot of air travel, a lot of small and crappy airplanes, pardon my French. So, you know, the travel tends to be the most dangerous part of it, or getting into cars. The wildlife is actually probably the most predictable and the safest thing I interact with on an average assignment, to be honest.
Well, tell us a little bit about that trip to Antarctica.
Well, I, you know, working, I try to, you know, again, in an ideal world, I would love to take everybody by the hand and take them diving and, you know, take them and show them these amazing places myself. But of course, you know, not many people have the opportunity like I do to spend most of my year exploring these places. So, you know, especially remote regions where very few people will ever get to go. I think those are places we really have to put an extra unique spotlight on. And some of these remote islands around Antarctica, I think, are right at the top of my list. You know, they are, you know, incredibly sensitive to climate change. Penguins and albatrosses and krill, I mean, we're losing ice sheets left, right, and center in the water temperature increasing. So I think it's places like that that really need to be on the radar. And since so few people ever go there, it's even more critical for a photographer to myself to kind of, you know, go out there and brave the elements and bring back images and stories to be able to share that place and the passion and highlight its fragility and try to, you know, motivate and encourage everybody to change their behavior in such a way that these places have a future and that the species have the chance to survive beyond the next century.
Are penguins badly endangered?
You know, there's lots of penguin species, but what's happening a lot around the Antarctic, that with the water temperature warming up and the ice disappearing, the penguins are losing a lot of their habitat, and they're also losing a lot of their food sources that are ice-dependent. So, you know, penguins now have to travel further and further afield from their breeding islands to find food, which makes it harder for the young chicks to actually get the nutrition that they need. So, you know, Antarctic penguins are in real trouble, and they live in a place that nobody ever sets eyes on, really. So it's very easy for those sort of environmental issues to go, you know, unheard and untalked about because, you know, there's so few people down there bearing witness.
Well, I live here in Clearwater, Florida area, and of course, one of the things that we see a lot are the turtles that come here to our beaches. And we have certain times of the year where people who live on the beach are supposed to keep their lights off. And, you know, we have people who are out there on patrol and putting, you know, ropes around the nests. Again, it's so hard to believe that, you know, we could lose these turtles because they are so magnificent.
No, and they are, and globally, you know, we've you know, And sea turtles are one of the species that actually, I think, has it easier than most because they do, you know, spend part of their life cycle, you know, showing themselves to us. You know, by coming up onto beaches and laying nests on land, I think so many more people are familiar with sea turtles, and that's why in many places, like, sea turtles are this wonderful conservation success story where populations are coming back in many places. You know, 50, 60 years ago, they were hunting for soup. And now there's this real conservation awareness around sea turtles, whether it's in Florida or in South Africa or other places. And I think that's largely because they do spend part of their life cycle on land. And that's when people get to interact with them in a meaningful way through tourism or through other means. So I think, you know, sea turtles are this wonderful ambassador, I think, for the rest of the ocean because they do, you know, for part of their life, occupy, you know, an ecosystem that we as humans know and understand, which is, you know, the world beaches. It's much harder with ecosystems that so few people visit and actually understand and care about.
What are some of the most unusual, animals that you've photograph? What do you consider the most unusual that will really inspire people to think more carefully about what's happening in the sea?
Oh, yeah, there are so many incredible unusual animals, but I think I'm going to have to settle on a marine iguana in the Galapagos Islands. Now, this is a three to 4 foot long iguana species that lives only in Galapagos, and they get all their food by diving, you know, to the seabed of the ocean and grazing on seaweeds and algae. So you're diving there underwater in Galapagos. There are sharks and penguins and sea turtles and fish. And all of a sudden, you know, 30 feet down, there's this iguana on this rock. And it's munching away at seaweeds. And it's just this, and they look like little mini baby Godzillas. And it's this real, like, it's hard to believe, even for someone like me who's seen everything, to actually that sort of animal exists. And what's interesting is that they survive entirely on seaweed. And as the ocean warms because of climate change, the water gets warmer. And all these seaweeds die off, and they disappear. And these marine iguanas are left without food. And if the ocean remains too long, too warm for too long, they starve to death. And there are years when we lose up to 90% of the marine iguana population.
Oh.
Because the water is too warm and their main food source is gone.
Well, they were...
And most people have never heard of a marine iguana.
I know. It surprised me. When I think of iguanas, I think of, you know, the deserts in Mexico. I had no idea that there were iguanas in the water. And I thought it was so exciting to discover this. This was like a real... Whoa, it was such a discovery. I think once people see this, they'll be amazed.
Yeah, and that's why I dedicated an entire chapter in the book to marine iguanas and the Galapagos, because it's like one of those wake-up calls where, wow, A, I didn't know this creature existed, and B, I didn't know that it was at death's door in many years because of, you know, the warming of the oceans, and if the predictions are correct, this will probably become one of the first animals to go extinct in the Galapagos because of climate change.
Well, you have done so much. You have done so much to promote conservation. I know that you do a lot of TED talks. You go to a lot of events and talk to people, and I don't know. You know, you have to talk to world leaders and get them to listen to you. And then just the general public, if we would all take really an interest in preserving these animals, in preserving the sea, and supporting companies that are cleaning up the sea, it could make a big difference.
But, you know, helping to protect the ocean is not the exclusive domain of photographers like me or even biologists or conservationists. I mean, everybody can get involved. And I always say, never underestimate the power as an individual, as part of a community. You know, the fantastic thing is that once you fall in love with the ocean and its creatures and you've become aware of all these threats that are facing them, there are so many opportunities for you to get involved. You know, you can volunteer services to a local NGO, you know, trying to protect endangered marine wildlife, or you can donate to a grassroots organization that works with, you know, critically vulnerable ecosystems. And if you're passionate about the ocean, you know, share that enthusiasm and love with people, whether you're a photographer or a poet or a radio host or a writer or whatever you might be. Just, you know, share that love and become the eyes and ears for people who are not able to experience the marine realm firsthand. So I think, you know, people, you know, the individual has a massive role to play. And of course, the two most significant threats to ocean health right now are, one, overfishing, and climate change.
Well, now
combat both.
I know that this is exactly what we have to do. We have to combat both. Now, do you have a website that you want people to go to where they can learn more about your exciting adventures and about your conservation work?
So, the three best things to do, I think, is, you know, try to get a copy of Wild Seas, which is sort of a complete, you know, 15-year history of everything I've ever done and what I'm working on now. And then you can catch me on Instagram at Thomas Peschak, ThomasPeschak. Then my website is also, you know, thomaspeschak.com. And I think amongst those three, the book, the Instagram feed, and the website, you'll get a pretty good idea of what I've been doing and the marine realm that I care about. But also, it will give you an opportunity to get involved yourself and to become, you know, the solution rather than being the problem.
Well, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. And this is one of my recommendations for a book that everyone should get as a perfect gift to give to people on Thanksgiving Day, because to have a book on Thanksgiving Day after you eat that turkey and you're resting in the afternoon between games, it is wonderful to just sit back and read a great book. And Nat Geo books are always the best. And I want to thank you so much, Thomas Peschak, for being on Joy on Paper today. And it's been a joy to talk to you.
Thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye. All right. Whoa. You know, this is, it's going to be Thanksgiving Day is coming up, and definitely you want to get yourself this book. Hours of joy, just going through the book, looking at the photographs. And it's wonderful when somebody, you know, you're 10 years old and you make a decision that you're going to study, you know, the oceans, and you do it. And he's become really one of the top photographers in the world. His photographs, they're magic. They are absolute magic. How he does it, I don't know, because some of them look actually very, he's like very modest, but I think some of them were dangerous because he surrounds sharks and other not so friendly animals. So I thought it was just wonderful, a wonderful book. And now, I'm going to turn to a different subject. And of course, during this pandemic year, we've all been thinking a lot about diseases. And you know, it's sort of in a way nice to think of diseases that I don't know, maybe we have some answers for. So that's why I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper in a few minutes somebody who's going to talk about, well, about diseases. You know, what can we do? They are out there, and it's nice when we have somebody who actually knows what she's talking about. And so I'm just waiting for her to come on the program, and she's going to be telling us about the, it's called, you know, the, it's so funny. When you have an author on, and she's, the name of the book is Patient Zero. Patient Zero. And of course, we're thinking a lot about that nowadays. We're thinking always about Patient Zero, because we don't know the Patient Zero for this one. But I'm happy to welcome, maybe she knows. So that's why I'm happy to welcome Dr. Lydia Kang, MD, to Joy on Paper. And she's going to be talking about Patient Zero, A Curious History of the World's Worst Diseases. I never thought it would be a relief talk about diseases, but since some of these are past and maybe some of them are over, anyway, it's just really fun to welcome you to the program, Dr. Kang.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's good to be here.
Well, Dr. Kang, as I said, you know, we're all wondering about patient zeros at this time. So you are looking back in history and telling us about some of the main patient zeros that have affected our world. So first of all, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got interested in this subject.
Sure. So as you mentioned, I am a physician. I am an internal medicine doctor, and I practice here in Omaha, Nebraska. But I also write books. I write books for young adults and adults. And my co-author, Nate Peterson, and I, we have previously written a book together called Quackery, A Brief History of the Worst Ways to Cure Everything. And that came out in 2017. And that book was all about these really wacky and weird ways that people have always tried to heal themselves, including things like arsenic and mercury and, you know, insects, all sorts of weird things. And so we came to deciding on writing a second book, and we decided to write about more medical history. And it turns out that, you know, the idea of pandemics and where diseases come from was something that we were both very fascinated in. And so that's how the book started, but we actually decided on the book and started writing it before COVID ever happened. So it was very weird to have to write this during a pandemic.
Very well, it's a timely subject. It's something people are interested in at the moment. And I found all of the stories are fascinating. Now, being a Napoleon buff and having, like, I think I have about 100 books about Napoleon, I was particularly interested in the chapter about Napoleon and the Grand Armée. Do you want to tell us that one?
Sure, sure. So it's a story that not a lot of people know, but, you know, Napoleon did march into Russia with this gigantic army, his Grand Army, and the hope was that he was going to go and take Moscow. And he very much thought he had the upper hand. What he didn't realize was that the Russian winter was going to be incredibly brutal. You know, they were being attacked all along the way. But it turned out that they were taken down by a very, very tiny little microscopic thing, which was typhus, which is a disease that is actually spread by body lice. I know it's a little gross, but, you know, imagine you're a soldier who's going through this winter, you're wearing bundles of clothing, you're not showering, you're not changing. And so typhus killed off hundreds of thousands of these troops. I think they went in at the beginning of their march with like 600,000 men, and they came back with 27,000, just a fraction of all those men just died along the way, and typhus took a huge bite out of Napoleon's Grand Army.
Literally bite.
Yes.
Wow. It was really, of course, I knew the numbers, and I've always, you know, thought about it. It's just unbelievable when people, of course, have heard about the 1812 overture. So it was in 1812, people, and this happened. And what happened, you know, to Napoleon during this campaign was incredible, and the loss of so many people from one disease—it is mind-boggling.
It is, and I think that people, you know, we're focused on sort of what are the numbers with COVID right now. You know, how many people are dying, and you know, we are into the many millions of deaths with COVID, which is absolutely horrifying. But this book sort of reminds us, like, you know, infections are always trying to take us out by the millions all the time. You know, if you think in terms of measles and smallpox and how it hit indigenous populations in North and South America, you know, when colonization happened, it took out tens and tens of millions of people, just absolutely destroyed civilization. So, you know, there are these just huge history-changing things that happen as a result of infectious diseases in our past.
So how did you go about finding patient zero in some of these cases?
Well, we did a lot of investigating and a lot of research and read a lot of papers and things like that. And, you know, what's interesting is that oftentimes what people think of as the patient zero of a particular disease is not actually the patient zero at all. or it's a lot more complicated than that. It's hard to sometimes pinpoint and just say, that's the person, this person is responsible for everything. It's so much more complex than that. A lot of times it's about, you know, the globalization of trade. A lot of times it's about, well, you have a burning rainforest or you're trying to farm, you know, next to a wilderness, next to a jungle. And so, yeah, bats are going to be, you know, defecating in your pigsty, and then these new viruses are going to show up and start attacking people. So it ends up a lot more complicated. And I think the chapter on HIV, where we talk about the origin of the word patient zero, is really illuminates how wrong people can be about pointing a finger at what we think is the patient zero.
Well, tell us about that story.
So in the 1980s, you know, HIV seemed to hit the United States, and there was a lot of fear. There was a lot of anxiousness about what is this disease, and how are we going to get it? How are we going to get it under control? And so one of the articles that came out in 1984 by researchers was trying to track down some of the first people who had HIV and AIDS and what they had in common. You know, we knew they had known enough that there were some sexual contacts between some of the cases. And so they started drawing this little map in this paper. And so you had this map that looked like a little bit of a starburst, and all the rays of the stars were connected to this one person in the middle that they'd all had sexual contact with. And that person, all the people in the group were from California, and the person that they were all had in common was actually a Canadian man, and he was from outside California, so his designation was the letter O. And after the paper circulated, people started calling this index person, this person who seemed to maybe possibly give HIV to these other people, they started calling him patient zero. But it really was O, not the letter O, not the number zero. But it kind of made sense to call him patient zero because people, you know, if you sort of think of the metaphor of like an atom bomb, like the ground zero where, like, you know, all this, you know, death and destruction can come from, it really sort of caught on as, you know, this is the person who's responsible. But, you know, the person who it was, Gaétan Dugas, was not the reason why HIV, you know, landed on American shores. The story probably started way before that. And when you look into where HIV actually began, you know, how did it actually first come to humans? Probably happened more closely to around like 1908, not 1984. So the story is really complicated, and it took a lot of research to sort of tease out all the nuances of what happened, as well as learning about the origins of the term patient zero.
Well, of course, one of the people that we always think of as patient zero in an epidemic is Typhoid Mary, but of course she wasn't patient zero for the disease because, right?
That's right. That is right. But we do sort of like tend to think of her as a type of patient zero because, so Mary Malone was this Irish immigrant who was working in New York at the beginning of the 1900s, and she was a cook, and she was just trying to make her way, working with different families, cooking for them. But she was infected with something called Salmonella typhi, and it didn't make her sick, but she was a carrier, and anytime she used the bathroom and didn't wash her hands and just went, dug her hands right into, you know, cooking the next meal, she was passing on this this bacteria to all the people who were eating her food. And she made this, one of her famous dishes was something called peaches on ice, which was like an ice cream with like fresh cut peaches in it, which sounds delicious, but now nobody will eat.
I don't think.
So she would make these peaches on ice, and then the family would get sick and people would die. And she had no idea that she was the cause of this. And when people tracked her down and said, you know what, Mary, you're the reason why people are getting sick, she didn't believe it because she's like, I feel fine. It can't be. I think you're lying and you're just trying to vilify me, and this is really unfair. She went back into the workforce a couple times and sickened more people until she finally sort of got institutionalized and kept away from people, which is really sad because I don't think she truly understood what a danger she was. She felt very unfairly treated, but she wasn't really out to hurt people. She was just trying to make a living. So it was a really complicated story about, you know, the origins of Typhoid Mary.
Well, that brings us to washing your hands and wearing masks. Tell us a little bit about about this mask business and about the sort of the origin of this N95 mask, and most people don't even know what the 95 stands for.
Sure. So, masks actually have been seen. You know, there's a really great painting from 1720 of people are just cleaning up the dead bodies from the bubonic plague, and you see actual people in the painting wearing masks. So masks have been used for some time, and back then it was because they thought disease traveled in the air because it smelled bad. Like, they thought sort of rotting particles in the air would cause disease. That's what it was protecting people from. And, you know, by the early 1900s, we started seeing masks being worn pretty universally, like in operating rooms and sometimes in hospitals, things like that. But an interesting thing happened. So in the 1950s, there was this lady named Sarah Little Turnbull, and she was working for House Beautiful. She was an editor there. And she was asked by the company 3M, which is the same company that makes Post-it notes, she was asked by them to work on, you know, a polymer that could be made into ribbons. And as they were working on that, they realized that this polymer makes really great shoulder pads and brassiere cups. Towards the end of the 1950s, she had some, family members that were sick in the hospital, and she thought, you know, there's got to be a better way of wearing masks in the hospital to protect people or to protect patients. And so she worked with them again and helped develop the N95 mask, which, helps filter out 95% of these very microscopic particles that could possibly cause infection. So the N95 mask that people were so desperate to get early on in the pandemic, it's funny because I don't know if you remember, I remember seeing photos of people who were making their own masks at home because they couldn't buy any. And so I saw some people putting bras on their faces.
I did too. Yes. So when I read the book, I thought of that photos too.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
They probably no idea that there's actually a history behind.
Well, people can find out about that history and a lot more in this book called Patient Zero, A Curious History of the World's Worst Diseases. And it's by Dr. Lydia Kang and Nate Pedersen, right?
Yes.
Okay.
The book will be out next Tuesday on November 16th. And you can find me at my website, lydiakang.com. Thank you so much for having me. It's a really fascinating topic.
Well, I it is, and I will mention it again on Tuesday just to remind people that it's been released, okay?
Oh, thank you so much, and I appreciate you having me here today.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Kang. Great talking to you. Bye-bye now.
Great talking to you, too. Bye.
Okay, whoa, this hour went fast. Remember, it is Veterans Day. Make sure that you reach out and say thank you to a veteran in your life or just anyone on the street who, you know, you meet and you see they're wearing a uniform. Make sure that you say thank you so much for all that you have done for us. And in general, remember, you should say something nice to someone every day. And I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Big Ed. Thank you for pulling out the songs that we needed today. And Johnny Clark's promo, because that is a wonderful book. Check it out. Johnny Clark and Thomas Ryan Sr. Get their books and support a vet. They are what keep us going and what why we're here. So thank you very much to all of them. And I should have been a general because Ed salutes me every program, and I would have been a great general. Bye-bye now.
WTAN Clearwater
FM 106.1
WDCF Dade City
FM 102.3
WZHR Zephyr Hills
FM 104.3
Listen.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by Rocket Mortgage.
I'm Steve Kathan. Veterans Day at Arlington National Cemetery. President Biden is there for the annual wreath laying.
The single greatest honor I have been afforded as president is to stand before so many of you, those Medal of Honor winners out there, and talk about Veterans Day. Veterans.
Biden administration today is rolling out a new effort on Veterans Day to help vets who've had respiratory problems and cancers that have been linked to wartime toxins. There's been more court action in the battle over one of the major issues in the pandemic, mask mandates and public schools. CBS's Jim Crisullo.
A federal judge has overruled Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott's ban on mask mandates in schools, clearing the way for districts to issue their own rules. The judge said the order violated a 1990 federal law by putting children with disabilities at risk.
Well, there's pain at the pump all over the country as gas prices continue to rise, but it really hurts in California.
The price at the pump is around $5 a gallon at many gas stations here in the San Francisco Bay Area. The highest it's been since 2014, according to the AAA. James, a driver for Amazon, wasn't happy about how expensive it is to fill up his minivan.
Way too high. It's ridiculous.
The national average for a gallon of gas, $3.42.
I hate it. The gas is just too high. It's always been high in California.
The main reasons gas prices have gone up so much recently, increased demand as the economy recovers from the pandemic, and rising crude oil prices. Matt Bigler for CBS News, Oakland.
Well, gas stations remain closed in Haiti a day after the State Department urged U.S. citizens to leave the country. The lack of fuel has affected everything from hospitals to banks in the country. Gangs have blocked gas distribution for weeks now. The last white president of South Africa has died at 85. F.W. de Klerk made history when he released Nelson Mandela from prison.
The government has taken a firm decision to release Mr. Mandela unconditionally.
That was the beginning of the end of apartheid. The two shared the Nobel Peace Prize. Wall Street, right now the Dow is down 68 points. The NASDAQ is up 124. This is CBS News.
This hour's newscast is presented by Rocket Mortgage. Need to know what it takes for a home loan to fit your budget and your family? Rocket can.
Now it's time for the Only in America Minute, sponsored by MyPillow. Go to MyPillow.com and use promo code Bill. Here's your host, Bill Cochran.
Well, today's a somber day. Veterans Day. Veterans Day in America, where we honor those that gave their lives for this great, great country we call home. America. The people will be able to go and give flowers at Arlington National Cemetery this year, something they couldn't do for the last couple of years, but they're going not only to do that, but to honor. Because America owes so much of their freedoms to the veterans. The veterans, the day, it's today. So get out, maybe go to the cemetery, lay a flower at the grave of someone that died and went before and lived for this great country, because this is the great country in the world, the greatest country in the world. Think about it.
Did you ever think about hosting your very own radio show? Here's how.
Hey, Tampa Bay, did you know you can have a one-hour program on the Tantalk Radio Network for less than the cost of one 60-second announcement on many Tampa Bay stations? That's right. We'll put you on the radio for less than the cost of one 60-second announcement on many stations. Check it out today. Use your program to promote yourself, your business, or someone else's business. Call Lola Jean, the broadcast queen, 727-510-7622. That's 510-7622. Call Lola Jean now to check out your Tantalk network program. In addition to network radio, we'll stream your program in audio and video all over the world. Call Lola Jean now, 727-510-7622. Call today. Your network one-hour program can start tomorrow. Broadcast your message in audio and video on the Tantalk Radio Network.
Hey, you new to the area or just want to know about the best hidden gems and upcoming events? Stay tuned. Be Local Buzz with Devin takes you to these places, introduces you to the best businesses, and tells you about upcoming buzz. Preset your radio to Tantalk 1340 AM or 106.1 FM every Thursday from 4 to 5. That is the Be Local Buzz with Devin on Tantalk 1340 AM and 106 FM every Thursday from 4 to 5. Looking forward to speaking with you.
Hello there, Tampa Bay. This is former NFL and college football coach Jimmy Johnson. Listen to the Kelly Kelly Show every Monday starting at 5 p.m. They can sure use the attention.
And this is former Major League Baseball player, Hall of Famer Wade Boggs. I also hope you listen to the Kelly Kelly Show every Monday starting at 5 p.m. They can darn sure use the money.
Hi there. This is Marine Wildlife Artist and Conservationist Dr. Guy Harvey. Please listen to the Kelly Kelly Show every Monday starting at 5 p.m. They need to feel worthy.
Hey guys, this is Audra Christian over at Tan Talk Radio. I'm inviting you to listen to my new show, The Audra Christian Show and the Real State of Real Estate. We plan on focusing on everything that affects your home in the Tampa Bay area. I love being a realtor, would love to guide you into buying your next house or selling your next house. Come listen to everything that affects real estate in the Tampa Bay area, Tan Talk Radio, every Tuesday, 4 p.m., 1340 a.m.
The Brian Cash Closed Coupon Book is giving out free masks. Just call 727-804-6082. If you need a mask, we'll get it to you for free. That's our donation back to the community. The Brian Cash Closed Coupon Book. Free masks. 727-804-6082.